tonight and return with me to the Gospel of John 2, chapter 7, where we were. Again, some things really concern me as pastor, and it's not that I see sins in the church and I feel a need to preach on them. I just feel that when we have a problem that has really become institutionalized in churches, in fundamental churches, and prejudice really has, it's become something that's been acceptable. It's become something that we've just, oh, thank you. Yep. You're good at that. We've got to look at what the Scripture says, and we've got to see things as they are. And I really believe that especially independent, regular Baptists, we have to realize that we've got a lot to overcome, especially in the area of racial prejudice. We say our schools are open and we don't discriminate and anybody can come who wants to. And yet we have less than 0.5% of all of our students in regular Baptist schools are minorities. Now, we would look at that and say, well, I don't believe in quota systems. But people, when you're dealing with a country that is now 42% minorities, and your schools only have less than 0.5% minority students, it doesn't mean that you are prejudiced against them, but it certainly means that they feel you are. And there, if we had that kind of evidence weighing against us and we were the minority, we'd say there's something wrong with your movement, there's something wrong with your schools. Well, I think it's not our schools that are in trouble, it's our movement that's in trouble. It's very, very difficult for us to understand that we are not presenting ourselves correctly. And part of it has to do, we'll talk tonight, that as separatists, we really open ourselves up to charges of being closed-minded and being prejudiced, because we often are. We often cross a line that's there. So I want to talk about that tonight. Last week, we worked our way down through pretty much down through chapter 44, and I was trying to tell you where prejudice comes from. One of the things I didn't deal with, but as we had talked about, prejudice comes out of a fear of being threatened, a political view of the world, where everything is power. I want what you've got. I'm going to guard what I have. I don't want people taking it away from me. We talked about ignorance. It's learned in the home. Kids don't learn prejudice at school. They learn it in the home. There's another institution where people learn prejudice. It's called the Army. I cannot tell you how many young kids I've known that have gone away and all of a sudden they've been put into the Army situation. Maybe not when you were in the service, but today there is a very, very much, it used to be that whether the whites felt it or not, the blacks were very, very heavily discriminated against in the military. Advancements for blacks compared to whites was just ridiculous. But forces in the 60s changed the picture, and the black consciousness movement made it so that blacks in the military had to think of themselves as being black, had to identify as being black servicemen, otherwise they were ostracized by other. The term used to be black, now it's African American, and my political correctness is going to go all over the place tonight. But it's interesting that the separation is now coming from the minorities in the military, and they want the other minorities to identify with them, and so it causes a terrible division and strife in the military. I've known several people recently who have talked to me about that and said that I wasn't prejudiced until I got into the military. And now when I see somebody who's black, I think of that, and that's my whole experience when I see somebody who is different. I'll tell you another place where it really came out, in the Vietnam War. If you've ever talked to many of the veterans of the Vietnam War and seen the attitude they picked up about Orientals, just a contempt for Oriental life. I talked with a man who was the winner of a Silver Star. I don't know if you know about the military, but Silver Stars aren't just handed out. That's not just you did something. That is, usually they say a Silver Star is a guy who deserved the Medal of Honor, but he didn't have the political situation. In other words, he didn't have the oomph behind him, and his commander didn't have enough juice to get it gone all the way up to Congress. This was somebody who was mentioned in a Newsweek article. I worked with him when I was in school, and he was telling, he worked as a command sergeant on a helicopter, one of the helicopters that picked up the wounded, And apparently you've got your pilots, but the guy who's in charge of everything that goes on in the back was a tech sergeant, and he was running the show. And he was telling me some things that happened to him. One time, they were pulling down into a little hamlet to pick up a wounded soldier, and there's a crowd of people gathered down there, all kinds of people, where they're trying to land. They could see from a few houses away they were bringing over the wounded man, and all of a sudden bullets start to ping up against the bottom of the helicopter, just pinging up. Now, they're not going to go through the bottom, but they come up the sides and in the door and like that, and whatever wanted to pull away. And this guy told me, this is his own words, he says, I said, don't bother. He reached over and got, it's called the bloop gun. It's a gun that fires a little grenade, about yay long, and it fires a little grenade like that. Put it over the edge, right into the crowd, and fired it. He says, I don't know how many civilians I dusted, was the term. And he said, but they're only slopes. And he said, and I had a wounded soldier over there. Well, he's talking about there was probably some kind of Viet Cong agent among there, and he didn't think twice about killing men, women, and children because they were, he called them slopes, Orientals. Well, where does that come from? Was he born that way? Did his parents have a No. He went over there, he got in a situation where it was us or them. And so I have a complete contempt for your life. It's me or you. And he viewed all Orientals as their life wasn't worth a piece of paper, wasn't worth the time it took to think about it. And again, we sent him over there. Okay, so we were part of that. And I do think that as Baptists, we've got to look at this is something that's a serious problem in the world. And it's killing, it's ripping America apart. Do you think the Los Angeles riots were just an aberration, a once-in-a-lifetime event? Hey, that's all over America. And I don't know of anybody in their right mind who justify that kind of animalistic activity. But there's a lot of tension and prejudice that is fueling that. And I think we've got to look as a church and say, are we addressing it? Is the Church of Jesus Christ going to address what's wrong in society? You look at what the prophets wrote about in the Old Testament. When something was wrong in society, they said, that's wrong, and we don't want to be identified with it. Jesus spoke out against the things that were wrong in his society. He didn't simply preach the gospel. He also said, this is wrong, and that's wrong. This is why you need the Lord, and this is what the Bible says about that. Paul and others would speak out against the evils and the ills of their society. But we don't. We have I hate to call it a pet list because there certainly need to be addressed, but we have a list of things that we want to talk about. We want to talk about abortion. We want to talk about some of the things that are happening in the schools and the New Age movement and whatnot. But prejudice. We don't want to talk about that. We don't want to talk about the fact that, yeah, there are people who are never going to be able to climb out of their economic situation. And it's institutionalized. We don't want to talk about what's going on in churches and how come the Church of Jesus Christ isn't reaching out into the black community, into the Latino community, which is just as bad a problem in the south of our country. We don't want to talk about how come we're perfectly willing to say we've got our churches and they have their churches. What kind of ministry is that? We've got our churches and they have their churches. Where do you see that in the New Testament? Where do you see Paul saying, well, the Jews have their churches and the Gentiles have their churches? The churches he ministered to were obviously both Jew and Gentile. Look at the church at Corinth. He dealt with things for both sides in both camps. Look at the church at Jerusalem. Look at the church at Antioch, had Jews and Gentiles in it. And that is God's racial division, by the way. That's the only racial division recognized in the Bible, Jew and Gentile. That's a real problem, isn't it? That means that you probably never thought about that, but God has two racial divisions, the Jews and everybody else. So you, me, Nelson Mandela, Mao Zedong, Mahatma Gandhi, and Leif Erikson are all one race, you know, and the Jews are another. We've got to think biblically. I don't think we need to turn into liberals, but we have let liberals steal the message we ought to be preaching. We've let them because we're comfortable, and I think sometimes we're a little closed-minded towards some sins we have. In chapter 7, we pointed out where this came from, what motivated them to this prejudice against Christ, and now I'd like you to take a look at the prejudice, to see what they were acting, and to see how the character of prejudice and maybe look at our own lives and see if it touches us. Notice, they sent the officers in verse 32 and the chief priest to take Christ. That's what they did. They sent him out there and they said, we want you to go and bring him back and arrest him. They go, they hear the words Christ had to say, and they come back without him. Verse 45, then came the officers to the chief priests and Pharisees. And they, being the chief priests and Pharisees, said unto them, being the officers, why haven't you brought him? We sent you out to do that. How come you didn't get it done? Now, these aren't men given to disobeying orders. Today, if you disobey an order in the military, there's a long, involved process that may net you some kind of problems. In those days, when you were sent out to do something and you didn't do it, the process was neither long nor involved. It was imprisonment, or you were physically flogged and beaten. They didn't kill a person for not doing orders. They simply took him outside and they flogged him and beat him and maimed him for life. So for these people not to do what they were told to do must have been an incredible thing. And the first thing I want you to notice is that they were blind to what was going on here. These chief priests and Pharisees were astounded and said, why didn't you bring them back? But they were blind to the magnitude of what they were dealing with. For men who are career soldiers, by the way, career soldiers then and career soldiers now are two different things. These were probably men we would think of more as security guards. The professional soldiers were the Romans, okay? And these were Jews. This was a Roman province now. But these were men who would be more like security guards or policemen or whatever. But it was their career, it was their livelihood. And that's how they made their money, and they knew where their bread was buttered. I mean, that's right where it was. For these people to go, and these were hardened people. The soldiers in those days and these kinds of people were not kind, tender, gentle-hearted people. Come back to the time of John the Baptist. When these soldiers came out to repent, John the Baptist pointed at them and he says, I don't want you getting involved with helping the tax collectors to extort money out of people anymore. And I don't want you doing your job, because their job was to act as bullies, as enforcers for the rich people. That was their job. And so these aren't men who are like a soldier today who simply goes in because out of love for his country and serve his country, or out of duty, and then he has his time off. These were professional soldiers. These were people who were like mercenaries. They were in it for the money, and most of their job was pushing around other people. And for them to come back without having done their orders, the Pharisees should have seen and said, there's something here more than I recognize. This must be a bigger problem than I thought. Maybe there is something to this. What could cause so great a change in people like this? Let me come back to prejudice. Prejudice is absolutely naive about the real state of affairs and the magnitude of problems. Again, when I deal with Baptists, and it frustrates me, we talk about problems in the world, and Baptists are so naive about the problems of race and racial prejudice. We don't even seem to talk about it or to deal with it as a problem. We don't preach about it. In America, it is causing such horrible problems. We don't even seem to understand that that is one of the greatest barriers to the gospel in the United States, the perception and the activity of prejudice. Why do you think many churches will not use the name Baptist in certain areas? Because it's been identified in the South in particular with prejudice. I don't agree with that philosophy. I like the name Baptist and I think it's important. But when it's totally and absolutely, I mean, what if you started a new Nazi party? But we're going to be fun. No more of that bad guy. We're going to be fun and we're going to start a new program. Would you call yourself Nazis? No. Nobody is ever going to get over the fact of what the Nazi party used to be. I don't know if you know, but the Nazi symbol, the swastika, is an ancient symbol of the sun and of peace. It comes out of Persia. The Aryan peoples who settled in Persia and the north of India and like that, you'll see the swastika was an old symbol. And it used to be a symbol for many things. And by the way, even American Indians, you'll see a little swastika. It was a symbol for the sun and for peace and life and vitality. But you wouldn't wear that as a peace symbol anymore because it's been ruined. And the fact prejudice and the perception of prejudice has ruined our testimony in the inner city. And we're blind to that. How come we can't reach in the inner city? Well, because it's drugs and the family problem. I'll tell you how come our movement doesn't reach in the inner city. It's because we have become identified as a white middle class movement. And we're perfectly happy to reach the white middle class. What would have happened in the early church if they were happy to become a Jewish middle class movement? And they didn't want to get out there, and they didn't want to reach some from every tribe and nation. They didn't see the problem. And Paul's ministry was telling the Jews, who were as bigoted as anybody on the face of this earth, the only time the Jews tried to kill Christ, or tried to kill Paul, was when he said, I want to go to the Gentiles. That, you look at, every time they tried to kill Paul was when he was talking about being sent to the Gentiles. That's when they wanted to kill him, because they were prejudiced and bigoted. And Paul's whole ministry, the apostle who wrote more books in the New Testament than any other person, that man's whole ministry was to break down racial barriers and to say the church is open to more than one race. And yet we're blind to the magnitude of the problem that's out there. We better recognize that. It's not something that we can say doesn't touch us. It is. It might not be a problem for you personally. I really trust it's not. But I want to tell you, it's your problem as a movement and as a church as a whole. It's our problem because it's there. It's on our shoulders. We're labeled with that. Sometimes we can cry about it and say, I don't deserve the label, but I don't care. If our kids come to us and have been involved and their testimony is bad, we wouldn't say, well, don't worry about it. We would say, if you've got a bad testimony, you do something to correct it. You don't want to carry that reputation around with you forever. And so it's a terrible problem. And I think just as these Pharisees, they were seeing Christ as a small problem and as another political movement threatening them. And it didn't dawn on them that if these hardened soldiers can have their hearts changed by Christ, there must be something more that I'm seeing. And I'm telling you that one of the things that Baptists need to first do is recognize that this problem of racial prejudice, there's more to it than what you've been seeing. There's more to it than what you're thinking. It's a very, very real problem for our movement, especially because, in my opinion, one of the number one lacks in our movement is evangelism. I think that is a terrible problem in regular Baptist circles, and this is one whole area of a barrier to evangelism that we're not even giving any thought to, that we're not dealing with. Notice what else. I just want to work through here and see how the chief priests practice prejudice and then apply it to ourselves. Why have you not brought him? The officer said, never spake a man like this. They said, there's never been another person who talked this way. This guy is unique. There is something different about this guy. Their approach was, he's just like every other pretender. He's just like every other person. He wants power. He wants to take it away from us. He's another false Messiah. He's not of us. So what's the big deal? Their point was, he's unique. The point of these soldiers. He's unique. He's different. There's something different about him. The chief priests, they're all alike. I'll tell you, we often talk about prejudice as discrimination. And I don't like to use that term. For one reason, the Constitution guarantees me personally the right to discriminate. Right? I can discriminate against you for just about any reason I want. I can say, I do not happen to like this about you, and I have a perfect right to my opinions. Correct? If I decide that I don't like you because you part your hair in the middle, that's my right to discriminate. An institution cannot discriminate. Okay? An individual can discriminate. The law only forbids institutions from discriminating. The point about prejudice that bothers me is prejudice isn't discriminating, it's being indiscriminate. It's discrimination is when you look at one person and see something about them and think something about them. Being indiscriminate is when you don't separate a person from his race, when you don't separate the individual from the group. All black people are like that. Well, you know the way black people are. You know, all Latinos are like that. You know Latinos, or you know what they're like, or you know what those kinds of people are like. You are not being discriminate. You're not recognizing that, hey, he's an individual. He's a person. He's not necessarily that way. You cannot look at any group of people and say all people are like that. You can't do that. That's not discriminating. That's failing to discriminate, failing to recognize that he's a unique person and that there are unique things that motivate him. I see this all the time. We tend to put labels on groups, and then any person who comes out of that group, we just assume he must have that. One of the worst things for black guys when they come to a regular Baptist school is everybody assumes they're going to be on the basketball team. It is true. You talk to them, a black guy goes there, and all of a sudden, oh, you're going to be on the basketball team. And it's embarrassing to them. One of them, Larry Wigdon. Do any of you know the Wigdons? Wigdon is an interesting family, an interracially married family with tremendous musical ability. Oh, these people were. Larry had, most people have more athletic ability in their little finger than Larry had in his whole body. And he had more than the rest of his family. I mean, his family, they were musicians, they were not athletic. And he said, it gets downright embarrassing. People assume that because my skin is darker, I'm going to be out there playing basketball and spitting watermelon seeds. You know, and they do. People really do. And it's a terrible thing because the association is, oh, black, you must play basketball, or you must be good in sports, or... And you say, well, what's wrong with that? Well, the assumption isn't, oh, black, oh, you must be interested in languages, or you must be here because you love the Lord, or you must be here. How dumb. We see an individual, and we label him with all of what we have seen from the group. We fail to discriminate. We fail to say, you are an individual, and I'm going to think of you as an individual. I'm not going to treat you that way. Duane gave me something from last week's Sunday school lesson, which is in my pocket at home right now. I'm saving it, maybe for a better message. I don't know. The point of that was the same thing. We don't treat people like individuals. We look at a person and we cannot get over the external characteristics that identify them with other people. Some guy walks into our church some night, a derelict by appearance. You know, a guy who's a smelly old bum. Are you going to invite him to sit next to you? Is he going to be sitting all by himself? Is he going to be over there in the corner because of his appearance? If so, we have a real problem in our church. If we don't look to the heart of that person and say, that's an individual who needs Christ, and I'd like to get to know him as an individual, and I'd like to see him that way. Since he's not here, let me mention, one of the guys who always amazes me is Mr. Perger. The kids were asking, you know, what does Mr. Perger do? And one of them said, well, I think he works up here as a guard in the home. What is that, the boys' home up there? Yeah, McCormick home, like that. He's just so big. He's an astronomer, you know. The guy's a PhD candidate in astronomy up here. But you see this big guy coming in. He likes to dress casual, which, by the way, you should have identified him as Cornell right away. People on Buffalo Hill dress better than the PhD candidates at Cornell do. But, you know, here he is. He's up there, and he gets labeled, and it's like, well, wait a second here. Talk to him. Find out. You'd be amazed when you talk to people and what you find out as a person. And you got to learn to strip away those layers that identify him with other people and realize he's different. I'll tell you, a terrible prejudice that comes that way in so many circles is male-female. We see somebody, men especially, as a woman, and nobody ever takes time as a man to think about her as an individual, to think about her as somebody who is unique and different, to think about her as a person and relating. Part of it is because men don't do a lot of that with people, period. But part of it is there is a terrible, terrible prejudice in our thinking and the division between men and women, and we group people in that category and never think of them as an individual. If you can't move beyond that and think of that one as a person, if that person being a female or that person being black or that person having some kind of visible situation, that if you can't separate them from the group and see them as an individual, that's wrong. And they couldn't do that. These soldiers who went said, there was something different. I heard with my ears and I know. He is different. He's unique. But the Pharisees couldn't do that. By the way, it's interesting, the Pharisees never went. They already made up their mind and sent somebody else to do it. Look what else. Again, one of my first points is it's not discrimination that's the problem. It's really being indiscriminate, failing to see people to discriminate and say they're an individual, and I'm going to separate them out from the pack and look at them as an individual. Notice, they went, they came back and said, nobody ever talked like this. By the way, they're giving him facts. They're saying, we heard what he said, and nobody ever spoke like this. Notice how the answers. Then answered the Pharisees, are ye also deceived? Prejudice is arrogance. Anybody who disagrees with you must be deceived. It's not that you disagree, it's you must be deceived. Are you deceived too? Are you so stupid and so dumb that these people have pulled the wool over your eyes? So often as regular Baptists, we tend to do that. Anybody we disagree with, there's something wrong with them. We don't look at them and say, well, hey, they have a different way of looking at things. They have a unique situation. Let's see it the way they see it. Oh, you're just deceived. There's something wrong with you. Let me give you some examples that might cut too close to home sometimes. A good example is the charismatic movement. There are some very sincere Christians in the charismatic movement. There really are. I despise the charismatic movement because it hurts people. But I have to recognize that everybody in the charismatic movement is not some kind of off-the-wall Looney Tunes person. Every person, by the way, who goes to a charismatic church is not an off-the-wall Looney Tunes person. You know, every time I have good friends who are members of Presbyterian churches. I have good friends. When we get together, I have to be very cautious not to tell them what I think about the beliefs of their church. But we've got to remember sometimes that we come across as being arrogant. Oh, you must be deceived. Oh, somebody has tricked you into believing that. Well, sometimes people choose to focus in on one item and they overbalance themselves in that area. And what they're believing is not right, according to my lights, but I can't be arrogant and look down on everybody with whom I disagree, everybody, and say, you're deceived, you're deceived. They're just looking and emphasizing a different set of facts than you are. Now, does that mean, great, let's go on out and, you know, have midnight teas with all the charismatic churches in a community? The answer is no. But we come across as being the fool on the hill. As regular Baptists, we really do. We separate ourselves, and you're looking down on the whole world around you. I am as separatist as just about any pastor in the New York State. I'd be on the right wing of New York State, which is on the right wing of the GRBC movement, which is on the right wing of evangelical Christianity, which is on the right wing of all Christianity. You know, I'm so far on the right, I just about ready to fall off the edge. But one thing that really bothers me is by being over there, it's one thing to be on the right, but it's another thing to be perceived as being on top looking down. That I'm separate from you, and the rest of you, you're not worth anything. And we come across as being arrogant. You're deceived, and you're deceived. I try to be very, very cautious in speaking, especially publicly, about people with whom I disagree and people that and movements and churches. I think we've got to be real cautious, because as soon as you come across as being arrogant, nobody will listen to you. They feel it's prejudice. Nobody will. You're not to them. You're no longer speaking truth and fact. You're coming across as being arrogant. You're coming across as looking down. Anybody with whom I disagree, you must be deceived in some way. Hey, that's wrong. We can't stand on top of people and look down at them and feel that the reason why I disagree with you is you've been deceived and you've been tricked into believing that somehow. That's the kind of prejudice. And by the way, that is, if you go outside of the GRBC movement, that's how people perceive us. When you go outside our circles, do I think we deserve it? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. But I don't want to even have a hint of that. And now that it's there, I've got to work extra hard. I don't need to correct every person I meet about every doctrine. When I speak about with pastors or with people, for instance, Florence showed me something from InterVarsity that was, they have a very active movement on campus. I personally would have a very difficult time being involved with InterVarsity. But if I was talking with a student about InterVarsity, first thing is you wouldn't catch me running it down. It's a Christian organization, and they're giving the gospel. And when I'm talking on campus, I have no reason to run it down. Second, I have nothing better to offer them. Correct? I mean, if I've got an active group on campus that's really working and doing something, then maybe I could say, well, I prefer this group. But I don't. So I don't do it. Third, so often when we think that we're correcting someone, what we're really doing is being arrogant. Well, you don't know the real facts about this organization. You don't know what's wrong with it. Well, maybe they don't. But on the other hand, am I in the position to talk to them about it? Is it my job to correct everybody? Is it my job to set everybody straight on everything? Well, you're deceived and I'm in the position to correct you. No, I think a church, and even as an individual and a pastor on campus, I can be separatist and say, no, I work through my local church, and I try to keep my local church on track with doing things that we believe in. I cooperate with people who have our way of thinking because that's the best way to get things done. You know, I wouldn't join a team where one of the coaches is a baseball coach and the other one's a basketball coach. You know, sorry, if I want to get involved with the team, I want both of my coaches, if it's a baseball team, to be baseball coaches. I don't want to be of two minds. And so basketball is okay and baseball is okay, but I only want one game plan. I only want to be playing one game at a time. But I don't need to run people down. And the arrogance that comes across, and pretty soon it turns ugly. The arrogance of just thinking that you're on top and that everybody else must have a deception problem. Look at how ugly it turns here. Have any of the rulers of the Pharisees believed on him? Hey, don't do your own thinking. I mean, look at us. Have any of us believed on him? No, so they must be wrong. We're the ones who know. We don't do it, so why should you do it? Have any of us believed on him? How would that have come across to the soldiers? Would that have been a convincing argument? Would that have been something where they would have said, oh yeah, that's right. You're such nice, broad-minded people, so fair. I should take your opinion all the time. Their idea was the people should listen to us. We'll do the thinking for you. Let us make judgments for you. Let me turn the tables a little bit and say the place I see that today is the press. The opinion of the press today is we'll do the thinking for you. They pick which stories will air and which stories will not air. They pick one side of things. There's a conservative commentator. His name is Rush Limbaugh. Everybody has a different opinion, but I noticed the other night they went out of their way to find a cousin of Rush Limbaugh's who's a rank liberal to talk about how he disagreed with him. Boy, if they dug up my cousins who disagreed with me, it'd be rank indeed. You know, you don't shake the Smith family tree too hard. You're not sure what'll fall out of it, you know. Come to a family reunion and you look around and it's like, oh boy, Dad, you know, I'm in strange territory now. But the press presented that. And they were talking about it like, oh, well, here's a real problem. And what people don't see, in Denver, there is a black conservative commentator who's on the radio. Denver has a terrible, terrible, terrible problem with gang warfare. There's a deacon from my church in Laurel, the Rogers, who moved to Denver. Their neighborhood is so bad, his wife carries a pistol, an automatic weapon, in her purse, has a license for it. Now, you've got to know these people. She's not the kind of woman who's just going to go out there. She's quiet and she's meek, and that's a bad neighborhood. Murders out on their street and whatnot. They're military, and the military moved them out there. But this guy is a conservative. So what did they do? They went into the neighborhoods and interviewed people who said, well, he would say, listen, what's wrong with blacks is not the white system, it's our families, and it's our lack of morals, and it's our lack of whatever, which, by the way, he's not saying anything that's a whole lot different than the black Muslims, but they got all the liberals who condemned him and said, he's nothing but a troublemaker, and he's hurting the black community, and he's a traitor. Well, the news media chose to take that angle on it. You never heard. By the way, they couldn't be fair to him. They couldn't let you hear everything he had to say for the last 6 months. They couldn't let you hear the tone of what he had to say and to hear him on the radio. People pick and choose. And it's arrogant. It's like, listen to us. We know. I'm the great defender of the people. Does anybody else believe that way? Phil Donahue is the best person in the world at that. He gets that crowd behind him, and he will talk to the people like, I'm the voice of the people, and everybody knows. And he'll be so disgusted, in my opinion, disgustingly arrogant towards his guests as if he's the voice of the people. That's prejudice. I don't care who's doing it, that's prejudice. And you can't be the voice of the people. You can't act as if I'm not deceived, you're deceived, I'm so much above you, look at us. And it's even uglier than that, notice. But this people, circle that phrase, who knoweth not the law, are cursed. There was a phrase in Hebrew, this people. In English, it doesn't look very bad. In Hebrew, it was terrible. They were called the people of the land. What had happened was that in the time of the captivity, when Nebuchadnezzar came in and destroyed Jerusalem, He took all the best and the brightest and the worthwhile people out of Jerusalem, all the artisans, all the scholars, all the priests, all the people, the best people, and he left behind the dregs. He left behind the people who were absolutely worthless, and that was a pretty clever policy, because it's not destroying the land, it's making sure that the people who are in power are absolutely a worthless group of human beings, and they turned out to be that way. So that when Ezra and Nehemiah came back into the land, the people they faced, the Jews they faced, didn't even resemble Jews. They weren't keeping the law, they had intermarried, there were all kinds of terrible practices because all the best ones had left. And they called those people, the people whom they returned and found in the land, the people of the land, the lowlifes, the, you know, just the scum of the earth is another way of putting it. And that's what this phrase is in the Hebrew. And this is certainly what they were speaking here. Okay? This people, he's referring to them as a disgusting term. He's just using this kinds of people and these kinds of people. They're cursed. They don't know the law. God doesn't care anything for them. They're cursed. Let them deal with the problem. Who cares about them? There was one period in my life where I was very interested in the mafia. Don't ask me why. Reading books on it, and, you know, and organized crime and reading up on it when I was in high school. And it's interesting. Do you know why drugs really prospered in the inner city? Because there was a time where the mafia made a conscious decision that we cannot stay out of the drug business. There's too much money in it. And money is, of course, what rules the show. The more money you've got, the more judges you can buy, the more guns you can hire. And that's why drugs today have really put the mafia and turned the mafia up on its head, because all these little groups like the Haitians and the Jamaicans and whatever, there's big money in the drugs, and so they can get involved and become very powerful overnight. Their decision was, we'll peddle it among the blacks. The black people don't have any soul and they don't care. They're less than human. So they made a conscious decision that they would promote the sale of drugs among the blacks. Well, we don't, most people, I mean, it's a fact, it's documented. They admit that themselves. And you see it in their, all these testimonies that came out. I forget who the, I don't know, was it Kefauver? The senator who had those crime hearings way back in the 60s, and Estes Kefauver. Well, the point is, it was an attempt to say, those people aren't, they're cursed anyway, so let them have the drugs. I'll keep it away from our neighborhoods. And it's interesting that there were no drugs being sold in Italian neighborhoods. They didn't want their kids involved in that. Sell it among the blacks. Well, that's what these people are saying. Why do you care about the people? They're accursed anyways. They're on their way down. Who cares about them? Let me tell you where that hits us. I think that to a certain degree, that attitude is permeated our attitude towards the inner city. And I don't care if the inner city we're talking about, blacks or Latinos or other minorities, pretty much the GRBC has decided that the inner city isn't worth the effort. You know, the missionaries that we send out, where's the biggest concentration of population in New York State? Tough question, right? Where is it? How many missionaries do we have in New York City? Okay, but he's not a GRBC missionary, is he? How many? Two. How many missionaries do we have in upstate New York? From the mission boards that we support? About 15. We got a state with one of the largest concentrations of human beings on the planet, and our missionary effort is directed. We have missionaries in towns that have about 8,000 people. And we got a place that's got, what, 10 million people. Why is that? Now, does that mean that that guy shouldn't be in the little town? No. If God directed him there, I don't want to deal with individuals, but look at the big picture. There's something wrong when our push is towards the little places upstate. By coincidence, they're white towns upstate, just purely coincidence, and you go into the inner city with the highest concentration of people, and nobody wants to go there. I know I don't. But it's like, I don't want to deal with that. It's growing to pot. Let that take care of itself. If I could put it, I've often felt that way about San Francisco. You know, just build a wall around the place and let them do what they want to do, as long as you don't let them out. but that's not right, you know. But we do that with New York City by not sending missionaries in there, by not putting our heart. How many of our missionaries in upstate New York go into the inner cities? How many missionaries do we have in downtown Syracuse? Downtown Rochester? Is there a downtown Binghamton? If there was, you know, how many would we send into there? I don't know what's downtown Binghamton, and it doesn't strike me as downtown. It just strikes me as... But, you know, our hearts are wrong. And we treat them as, oh, they're just in a... It's all going to pot. Who wants to go there? But look at our missions emphasis. And there is no way that I can stand before God and say that isn't prejudice. I prefer to go to my own kind of people. I prefer to be with my people. Let's send blacks to the inner city because they're used to it. Well, that would be a great answer if there were blacks in our movement to send to the inner city, wouldn't it? We don't have them. Is that what God did? Said Paul, I'll send Gentiles to the inner city, full of Gentiles. When you go through Greece and you go to the inner cities, they're pretty much Gentiles. And Paul witnessed to them, and we don't. And we do treat them like, oh, they're just, I mean, they're going to pot anyways. I'll put my effort some other place. Notice, Nicodemus said unto them, he that came to Jesus by night, being one of them, tremendous how God works this person back in, doth our law judge any man before it hear him? He said, what you're doing is unlawful. You're the judges, and you're going to judge this guy, and it's unlawful. Our law won't judge any man before it hears him. You're saying the people are cursed, and you're saying that this guy is a deceiver, and you didn't even go listen to him. You're being unlawful. That's what the word prejudice means, prejudging. You've judged a person before you've heard what he has to say. Just a couple quick examples. There was a big thing last year about the movie X, Malcolm X, and like that. We got together in a pastor's meeting, and I couldn't believe the ignorance I was hearing. That, well, I don't want to support Malcolm X because he was a racist and the movie's about racism. Do you know why Malcolm X was killed? Anybody? Malcolm X had a religious experience. He went from being a black Muslim racist, and he had a religious conversion to genuine Islam, as opposed to black Muslim, which is kind of a black political movement, and he renounced the racism. He renounced all of his positions, and he was killed because of that. And that's what the movie's about. Well, again, people get so, and Malcolm X was a very, very politicized figure and very, very well-known figure, but people don't know that. And we judge him without knowing that fact. If you ever read his autobiography, that's what it's all about. His autobiography isn't about how rotten white men are and this and that. His autobiography is about how he went through that and changed because of religious conversion to Islam. And we judge a person without knowing those facts. We just have these things in our mind, these images in our mind. We can't be prejudiced. You can't judge a person without hearing what he has to say. And we do that all the time. Even in our schools sometimes, it's very, very hard to get our kids into the original manuscripts to see what these people have to say for themselves. We give them, well, this is what so-and-so believes, and this is what this movement believes. And when you go to Bible college, it's very, very much that way. This is what these people believe, but you never read what they have to say for themselves. Nothing's ever as simple as what you read in the Bible college exams. What do Methodists believe? I mean, how would you like to say this is what Baptists believe? Oh, come on. Which one believes that? You know, there's no group, and people don't look, and they can't. We just don't have the time. We don't make the effort. But when you have unfairly judged somebody before you've heard him, and Nicodemus stands up, and all he says is, does our law judge somebody before it hears him? Notice, and they answered and said, art thou also of Galilee? They don't want to hear it. When a person's prejudiced, you can't convince him. His mind is closed. His idea is, not only are these people wrong, but anybody who identifies them must be wrong. Are you a Galilean? Are you one of those dumb hillbillies too? Are you of Galilee? How stupid can you be? Search and look. Interesting, those are the words Jesus used to the Pharisees. Search the scriptures and see, for they are the ones that testify of me. They said, search and look, for out of Galilee arises no prophet. No prophet has ever come from Galilee. They said, that's dumb. How stupid can you be? He claims to be the Christ. There hasn't even been a prophet coming out of Galilee. Let's talk about that. If you turn, I wrote the reference down here, 2 Kings 14:25.
Somebody turn there and tell me where Jonah, the prophet, came from.
Kings 14:25. Anybody? Gath Hepher. Okay, Gath Hepher. A lot of places in the Bible we don't know where they are. Some places God is very specific about where they are. Gath Hepher is one of them. It was one of the cities on the border of the tribe of Zebulun. So it's interesting. This is one of the few places. You could say, well, he was from Gath Hepher, but we're really not sure where that was. Gath Hepher is one of the few places that were absolutely positive where it was. Turn with me to Joshua 19:13. Real quickly here. Well, he said search and see, and so that's what I want to do. Search the scriptures and see if a prophet comes out of Galilee. So let's just take a moment to do that. Joshua 19. This is the division of the land. Okay. Verse 10 says, the third lot came up for the children of Zebulun, according to their families. And here is the inheritance of the border of Zebulun. Just plain ignorant. I mean, search the scriptures and see it. Was there ever a prophet who came from Galilee? Yeah, one of the few prophets who we knew where he was from, Jonah. God went to lengths. By the way, not all the prophets do we know where they're from. Isaiah, we don't know what his hometown is. You know, some of the there are many prophets with no idea where they came from. We know where Jonah was, and it's one of the few towns that we know exactly where it was located. And it's 3 miles from Nazareth. It's in Galilee. Search the scriptures. Does any prophet come from Galilee?